In fact, someday I hope I'll be able to listen to music while I'm lecturing. So, okay, if your boss says he can't find something on your website, there's two ways to respond. One is to say, boss, you're an idiot. It was there all the time. Here it was. You just had to look down here and over there and around the corner. The other is to do what?
Change it.
Use that as constructive feedback and make your site easier to use and a little more accessible, right? So I'll just offer that for food for thought. So let's see, where are we here on design constraints, right? Okay, so let's talk technical design constraints. And again, this is constructive, so you know, I encourage everyone to participate. We're not here to beat up on a particular group, but to help everyone grapple with this issue. So tell us about the project. Tell us, and then give me your two-sentence description about the project. Excellent. So small, I heard small portable solar concentrator, and your job was to do
the tracking
and the motion and all that, which seems to involve some electronics. Okay, everyone has some concept of that. So technical design constraints. Based on what he said, let's talk about what are some of the things that you think might be relevant to that project.
Durability?
If it's portable.
Someone said, I think you said size? Because he said small portable. Portable?
Weight? How much it
weighs? Weight?
What grid is it connecting to?
Whether it's going to connect to the grid, yeah. That project, actually, we've had a number of projects worry about that, but we're not going to really deal with grid connectivity this semester because that is a little bit complicated. But you could connect it to your house or your circuit panel or something like that. Okay, and then he talked about tracking. The system's going to track the movement of the sun. What are some of the things you would expect with that kind of thing?
A motor.
There's going to be some kind of electronics, some kind of motor. What are some of the issues you're going to worry about? If I'm going to sell you a box that claims to track the sun, what are some of the things you're going to worry about?
Between the box and the position of the...
Exactly. The lag between the sun. What else?
Durability,
reliability. How long is this thing going to last before I have to do some maintenance on it? How it's going to sense the sunlight, which could get a little bit into approach, but there's a general concern that it's got to somehow track light and not other stray kinds of light. Like if you deployed this near a football stadium or something, when the lights go on, you'd hate to see this thing shift over and point at the stadium.
You might not even need a sensor if you calculate the position of the sun relative to where you are on the Earth. You can predict that. Can you?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that. We've been talking about the
location of the planets relative to your position in the sun.
But then that might require some user setup. Unless you could figure, you're like with GPS or something, figure out automatically where you are. That's a good point, though. Yeah, this was an interesting point. Go ahead.
I have this thing on my iTouch, and it's called Planets. And it just uses the mathematical calculations of the location of constellations and planets and the sun. And relative to where you are, it's going to follow a mathematical
formula. But that varies with the season, so if you put it fixed. Like, ideally you want like a south-facing, slanted surface at like a certain degree depending on how far now you are. But if in the seasons the path of the sun changes, especially like at noon,
Right,
no, but this dish, this,
no, yeah, I
This system is going to track the sun during the day.
Right, but if it's fixed, are you saying that based
varies,
on software?
It varies with the seasons too. Like it will like predict that. It
predictably
like
varies.
If you had the solar panel in the same position.
Yeah, but if you have it in the same year, I mean, all the.
So this is great. So we have some technical arguments going on about approach, which is good.
If you have it at the, you know, if you just bolt it on, you're not taking advantage of the full impact at certain seasons.
No.
He's saying you could actually, the issue is you could.
The prediction of the sun, it wouldn't stay still. It just wouldn't be a sensor that is moving. It would be the calculations.
The issue is whether you could predict the location versus have some kind of feedback where you track. And that's an interesting
In the solar decathlon, that's what they did. A team from Spain, they actually just used information they plugged in their current location, and based on that, they said, well, the sun is supposed to be at this angle, and did it that way. I mean, that is an option then.
Okay.
I understand what he's saying, and we actually were thinking about that, but the problem with that is the position is going to vary wherever you put the thing, so you would have to.
Well, that's what I said. So there's going to be so that's an interesting point because it adds a little more burden on the user on setup, but then maybe less technology or something. There are trade-offs on those kinds of things, and I think you all know in this day and age, we hate products that require lots of configuration when you open up the box, right? You just want them to. So there's some issues there. Okay, so here's what they came up with for. Technical design constraints, self-sufficiency. We will generate at least 13.6 volts in order to charge the battery that the control system will constantly run on. So tell me a little bit about that. Now, admittedly, I haven't asked you to explain these in great detail. That's what's coming when you do your revised design constraints. So they may have a good justification for that. But what are some of your concerns about that design constraint? When you read it out of context, what are some of the flags sort of that go off in your head?
That if the battery runs low, the system's not going to work. It's just going to stop working if the battery runs out. And it's using up.
Well, even more basic than that. So who are the we have one or two EEs in the room, right?
How long is it going to hold the charge?
No? Something more basic. Voltage, right? Where does 13.6 come from?
Motor.
If that's to power electronics, that's actually a pretty large voltage. If that's to power motors, that may be related to how the motors are being powered. So that's an example of this may be a valid thing, but as you now add the sections in your document where you explain your design constraints, that's a good example of something that needs to be explained. How did you arrive at the 13.6? But this is good in the sense that it's somewhat quantitative, though there are questions about this charging of the battery and issues like you're pointing out about batteries running, how much capacity do you have in the battery for storage and things like that. Energy production will generate at least 1/6 of the average daily home usage, or 5 kilowatt hours of power.
That should just say the amount.
Why?
Because 1/6 of the average daily home is
4 or 5 kilowatt hours.
I think, if anything, 5 kilowatt hours. It should be like 5 kilowatt hours, which is, you know, like a parentheses is about 1/6 of the average daily home unit.
Right. So I think just stating the actual energy delivered by the system would be a better way to state that, since the daily household could mean a lot of different things. The average daily home usage. Right. Accuracy. The tracking software will always maintain at least 90% of the maximum solar radiation absorption. Now, when I read that one, I was a little bit confused. Why? Analyze that sentence. The tracking software will always maintain at least 90% of the maximum solar radiation absorption.
Well, the tracking software will make sure that the system absorbs 90%. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So what? So does that really? At first read, you're thinking that somehow is going to talk about the precision of the tracking software. But it sort of indirectly talks about that, because it's saying, well, this thing will track well enough that you're going to get this 90% maximum solar radiation absorption. But really, I think what the intent here, especially since they called it accuracy, you'd like to see something a little more detailed on the actual tracking software itself. Why? Why would a more direct constraint be better than a more indirect than this currently somewhat indirect constraint? What's the point of making you do these design constraints?
Well, it helps you know when you achieved your goal.
No, a little bit more specific. Why are we doing these design constraints?
Address issues in the project.
Because what? Yeah, tell me.
It just shows you where.
How are you going to use these design constraints?
Prepare for the obstacles.
Well, but before you test.
Design.
They're called design constraints, right? How are you going to use these design constraints? You're going to use these to design your system. They're going to have a direct influence on how you design your system. So would it be easy to design the tracking software to this specification?
Sure. Yes.
Why?
This is kind of broad. The 10% is a lot for error.
But the ability of the software to track the sun is somewhat dependent on the other concentrator hardware, right? To achieve this 90% absorption.
So the tracking system?
So if you're writing the software, you would really like a constraint that deals specifically with your software so that you could test it independent of what the other team is doing on building the actual concentrator to achieve this absorption and kind of thing. So that you could sit in the lab and test your software, and you could do that as an independent piece. So I would say one of the risks here is this sort of mixes two different subsystems together. And it would be better to have a specification on the software itself, and then a specification on the mechanical system that positions, so that the software people can go off and do their thing and then interface to the other system. So another reason we do design constraints, and this is a really important thing in engineering, and I know it's something you struggle with at this point in your careers, is we want to decompose these very large, complex systems into lots of small pieces that can be done in parallel. And then you get all these little pieces together and you integrate them and to get your final system. You cannot do things in a sequential mode. One of the temptations is to say, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this, and then we'll be done. But what you really have to do is you have to break the system up into multiple pieces, do those pieces in parallel, and then have an integration phase and a testing phase, and then you go back and readjust the individual pieces. That's another important part of engineering, is decomposing problems into lots of small problems so that you can tune these systems somewhat independently of one another. Because when is this thing going to actually exist as a complete system for testing? When will the first time you all sit around your thing and say, there it is, let's test it? What? Well, let's talk dates. Give me a day when you're going to sit in front of your beautifully built system. When? When next semester?
Not in
beginning. We're talking probably, think about this, we're talking probably what, November of 2010, right? So what's going to happen between now and November 2010? Everybody's going to sit around and wait for somebody else to do something? No, you've got to build, you've got to have everybody working in parallel. And we're going to get into that more throughout the semester. I'm hoping this semester will actually have you set up Microsoft project documents that will sort of just break your project down into individual tasks and all that kind of thing. Time adjustment. The system will readjust itself once every minute in order to obtain the accuracy constraints. What do you think about that constraint? What kind of justifications would you expect to see for this constraint in this section?
The amount that the sun moves in a minute.
So they've made a decision that once every minute will be sufficiently accurate to track this thing, right? So we'll need some justification of that. What are some of the trade-offs? What if they said it once every hour or once every second? What are some of the trade-offs involved in that parameter? The energy required to move the dish. So if they're adjusting every second, they're going to use up a lot of energy just to keep the dish positioned. If they adjust every hour, they'll save energy, but there's a chance they'll lose position. You know, they won't track well.
Shouldn't this be optimized by not percentage of solar radiation, but by maximizing power?
Right. Ultimately, going to be one of the figures of merit of this project. There's sort of a bottom line on this project, which is the total amount of power generated and what's the other kind of major constraint? Okay. So how do we talk about cost?
Is it cost per kilowatt?
Not quite.
Cost per cell in the system?
Not quite. Close. You guys know. I've used this term before. What? The other term begins with an R.
Internal return
on
equity.
Investment. Right. So cost is valid, but really it's return on investment. Right. You want to know that if this is going to generate a certain amount of power, over what period of time is it going to pay for itself? With many of your projects, we have a number of solar projects. That's a really important issue this semester. Okay, so these weren't too bad, actually, for a first draft.
So if they're doing a tracking system, is the design constraints of it just the tracking system? Or?
Well, this project is, right, is the just the tracking component of the system. So I would actually like to see some more specific constraints on how the tracking system is going to work. There's issues, it's a control system, so there's some issues about that, and they're going to talk with somebody who's more expert in that to get a better idea of that. So on the practical or the non-technical constraints, we have cost. Total cost to the consumer for this product must be less than $500. Okay, so again, when you read that, what are you going to think about? We really want to know more about return on investment. $500 may not be expensive. In fact, if you have a really good one of the nice things about good return on investment is you can have a high profit margin, right? If your project is justified based on return on investment, you can sell it for whatever price you can justify based on return on investment. That's one of the reasons why people like a lot of these energy-related products is you have a good profit margin because you can argue that it's all about return on investment. Economic time. The solar concentrator. So this was an interesting one. The solar concentrator will be fabricated within a year, and we're also looking to produce a prototype of the software within 6 months. Now that's actually, when I first read that, I thought, darn, that's a good one. They kind of got me on that. Why does this constraint exist?
Because of class.
Right. So I thought, okay, they got me on that. This is very definitely a reality, but that's not really what we're looking for in a constraint. But what I would like to know are some of the economics of manufacturing. You know, how long will it take you, if you want to go this route, you know, if you have a product that has a complicated manufacturing process, you may worry about how long it's going to take to manufacture the product. Sometimes, for example, if you're, you know, if you're growing crystals or fabricating devices or something, the production times can get excessive. With respect to this, what's happened in the auto industry? The auto industry has actually paid a lot of attention to this kind of a constraint. How has the auto industry changed in the last 20, 30 years? And what's been the impact of that? No. It's
reliability.
When you go to buy a car today, when was that car built?
Like a week ago.
Some of the manufacturers talk about, when you buy a computer through Dell, for example, when you place that order, when is that computer likely being built? Within a few days of placing that order. That's called just-in-time manufacturing, and it's been the rage for a number of years. The automobile industry, when I was your age, they would produce all their cars ahead of time, ship them to the dealers, and that was all there was. Today, they're producing cars 1 or 2 weeks in advance in some cases. They're trying to be really responsive to customer demand and not have a large inventory. So that's something you might think about, though. For this course, I would discourage you from kind of going down that route. We talked about size. The concentrator control systems will fit in a 2x2 foot square. Is that an adequate constraint? I just actually noticed this. I have another complaint about that one. Yeah, what? It needs to be probably volume, right?
Well, the only reason I didn't include that is because I don't know where we're going to position the solar tracking thing. You know, Paul,
yeah, there are many things that the constraint, but we can't include that because...
Hold on. No.
There are many things in the constraints that we can't make them the way we want them yet because we don't know certain numbers aren't researched yet.
You really want to retract that statement? Because that's actually what I wanted to talk about today. So I have a long speech about this question. So say that again. Everybody listen carefully.
I know what you're going to say. You're going to have to make it up. But like, I can just throw numbers there. There has to be more research about it. And one thing leads to the other. And sometimes we need numbers that will come later.
Oh, will they?
They will.
Yes, they will.
So let's talk about that because I've heard this criticism from a number of students. I've gotten it every year I've taught senior design. But let's talk about how this works in the real world. Let's say you want to build a building. And actually, I forgot I was going to get a picture of a building. I was talking with a construction company in Mississippi where I was for quite a while, about midway through my senior design experience. And they were hired to build a casino in Mississippi. And I'm always fascinated with construction companies. Has anyone worked in that industry here? So have you been involved in pricing out, doing bids and things? It's amazing, isn't it? They do these billion-dollar bids, and they get them within 5 or 10%. So in this casino, they wanted to have a circle that was empty. You know, the building was going to have like a hole through it, like a circle. And I asked the president of the company had come to talk at school, and so I got a chance to talk to him. And he showed a picture of this. So after the talk, I asked him, "So how did you bid that job?" He said, "Well, you know, when we went to do that, we really didn't know how we were going to build this circle. We'd never done this before. We weren't even sure of the structural properties and all that. We weren't sure the metal could be bent that way. But they had to come up with a price for the bid job, right?" What? So? And if the company accepts that bid, they're bound to build that building for that price.
There is research to come up with that price, even if they haven't done it before.
So they had to do a lot of research, and then even then they had to make some educated guesses. because the fabrication companies they were working with couldn't really commit to how much it was going to cost to actually fabricate the curved steel and all that. Well, you know, this is what engineering is. In most engineering projects, you're going to be asked by your management, how much money do you need to do what it is you want to do? You're going to be asked that before you ever build this thing. And that's the process I'm trying to take you through this semester. Because I know you think it's backwards. I know you think we should be allowed to go and build this thing and figure it out, and then we can tell you how much it's going to cost.
Not build, but more time to do the research. I mean, I'm not saying we're going to build it and then tell you how much it costs, but it definitely has to be more research that has a lot of parameters that affect that research.
Right. So we're so how much time do you need?
More.
Well, we're what, about about 5 weeks into the semester, right? We're about one third of the way through the semester, and many of you are still struggling to understand some of the basics of your projects. So that's a, you know, that's a problem. Now, I understand this, and that's why we're going to iterate on all these things, your problem statements, your design constraints. When you come back in second semester, in the first week of the course, we're going to go through an update of all these things. Now, many of you are convinced that this semester is only a paper study. That's not true. Because one of the ways you're going to have to figure out some of these costs and some of these issues is to either do some amount of simulation or to do some amount of prototyping. So that's another way that you figure out some of these things, is you have to actually prototype a little bit. So what do architects do when they're trying to win a big construction project? No, but, and you've seen this in this building every so often. You see these projects going on. They build little models. And they actually have little people who walk through the little models, and they try to actually, sometimes you'll actually see them bending down and trying to look and get some sense of how this is actually going to look.
I did that. I was an architecture.
Really? You were? So you did you, you constructed models? I'm amazed. I love those little models that they built. They're really cool. How much, if you're bidding on a billion-dollar building, like one of these skyscrapers that they've just written, how much money do you think you're going to spend in the development of that bid?
20%.
20%? 10%. That sounded impressive. 10%. What did you call that?
Bid bond.
Bid bond. What does that mean? But how much money are you going to spend up front just to win that project?
It's a calculation based on how often you win bids. So if you win at a 25% rate, then you bid four times the amount it takes to win big.
Okay, so if you're bidding on that billion-dollar project, you're going to spend more than a few dollars, right?
Yeah.
You're going to spend a million? As part of that bid, you are going to actually build some pretty, typically, I mean, this isn't my area of expertise, but I've seen this. You're going to actually build some pretty detailed scale models of this thing. You're also going to lay out all the, like, you know, everything in AutoCAD or whatever, and, you know, have complete layouts of a lot of it, because that's the only way you can ultimately estimate costs and things like that. So you're going through that process this semester. You're trying to design and estimate a project that you haven't ever really built before. Now, if you were doing this in industry, what would your strategy be to make sure that you ended up with a good bid? What is the one big difference between senior design and the way a real company would go about doing this? Well, but you can do that in senior design. No. What about experience? The one disadvantage you have in senior design is that you don't have senior engineers who've done this before, this kind of thing before, right? But in a company, your upper management, you'll have senior engineers, senior architects who have experience who can help guide you through this process. In senior design, you don't really have that since this is the first time many of you are doing that, but that's why you have to work closely with your advisors and people like that. All right, let's look at one just for sort of kicks. Let's look at one more. So who we had the percolator people were encouraging me, right?
Yes.
These are not updated, right? These are what you submitted? Okay, so two sentences on your project. Two sentence description on your project.
We are attempting to design and build a low-cost filter that can be implemented in the developing world. Our primary constraint being affordability. So we want to make this lower than anything that's out there currently, or lower price per liter.
So what are some of the things?
Local resources.
Right. So what are some of the things that are critical to this project?
Price.
Even before price, I would say.
Effectiveness.
What do you mean by effectiveness?
It actually has to filter the water and actually has to provide clean drinking water.
Okay.
Because it's a health. Very important.
Right. When you drink this water, you better not fall over dead. Right. Now. What's one of the problems with selling water purification systems for the third world countries?
Do they actually want to clean their water?
No. I think. But I think you're. Well.
Maintaining and changing the filters and stuff like that?
Maintaining
the filters and changing the stuff.
No? Something more basic. If you're a third world country.
You need water.
What? Well, there are sections of the world, yes, that have water problems. But let's assume you're a third world country that has access to water. What's going to be wrong with that water?
You don't know.
Contamination. Why?
Because it's open pool of water.
What's one of the advantages of being a third world country? I hate to say it this way, but it's really true.
No regulation.
No regulation? What else? We had a. What? Okay, so let's make this specific. So you're across the border in Mexico, right? And what do you see if you've ever been down to the border region? It's pretty striking when you look across the border. What do you see? If you want to talk about down in Texas, what? No, you see lots of factories, right? Why are these factories across the road?
Because they're cheaper labor.
Not just cheaper.
There's
less regulation, right? They can do all sorts of nasty things and dump all those nasty things into the water systems and not have all the regulations that we have in developed countries. How does this influence the water purification system?
You can't use the same standards as you use here.
Because? The incoming water is going to be worse, and what about that incoming water?
It's unpredictable.
It's going to have all sorts of stuff in it. I hate to think what kind of stuff it's going to have in it. When I was your age, I was living in Chicago. We had the Chicago River. If you fell in the Chicago River, they had to rush you to the emergency room and give you all sorts of shots because there was likelihood you were going to die in the next hour or two. The water was that polluted. They used to have these pictures where people would put their hand in the water, pull their hand up, and it'd be like gunk. They've actually cleaned it up. It's pretty amazing. But and then every year they dye the river green. And in those days, they didn't worry about biodegradable dyes. They would just, like, dump green paint in there or something. I don't know. It was really unbelievable what they would do to that river. So this little product, this magical little gravity-based, low-cost water filtration system is going to have to deal with a lot of those things. So filtration efficacy, to remove 99% of all disease-causing bacteria. So is that a proper way, and again, this is not my area, but I think I know enough to know, is that a proper way to specify the how much, what kind of filtration this system has to do?
No, because I don't want 1% of the disease.
Usually they use like the size of the...
Don't they use like parts per million and things like that?
If you're talking about regulation, you have like one log removal, two log removal, and that has to do with how many zeros at the end. So like four log removals, 999.
There are other categories of contaminants that are in water, such as like volatiles.
So this might actually end up being a few constraints, right?
Well, the thing with filtering heavy metals and volatile organic compounds is that you have to use activated carbon, activated carbon is probably the cheapest, best way you can do it, and then that has to be replaced. Based on our literature review, we're trying to combat diarrheal diseases, which are most caused by bacteria. Mercury poisoning is, a child is more likely to die of diarrhea than mercury poisoning. They'll die of diarrhea first. So that's why we're targeting bacteria and not...
Okay, so all that's in your problem statement, right?
Is it? It should make...
Because that was really good stuff.
Is that recorded?
Yes, this is recorded. That was really good stuff. Get it in your problem statement. Affordability. What are the dimensions of affordability for this project?
Cost per liter.
Well, again, how would cost per liter? I don't know. I think there's a couple components to this.
Well, the thing is that
the dollar is going to be so expensive for them wherever it is.
What we're basing this on is the.
But there's sort of the construction costs, right?
Well, yeah, the for example, LifeStraw, our competitor, LifeStraw. You know, you just go up to a polluted source and.
Okay, in the back there. Come on, let's stay engaged, please.
And the cost to manufacture that is $2, and the cost. And it filters, I forget how many liters, but if you divide the cost per the liters filter or the lifespan of the thing, it comes out to 0.0028.
So this is sort of the operating cost, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, once you build it and once you have everything, and then say it costs, you know, 10 cents, but you can only filter 1 liter before you have to replace it,
right.
And it's 10 cents a liter.
Right.
But if it costs $10 and you can filter 1 million liters,
so all this has to be spelled out because these are all, I think with most of the projects, you all have a lot more knowledge about the projects than is coming across on the written word here on the page, but this is all good discussion and all that needs to be in there. The filter must be gravity powered.
Yeah.
This was another one I had a little bit of heartburn with. What would be a better way? First of all, that's not really quantitative. That's sort of binary, yes or no, but we probably need to think about flow rates, how many gallons, I don't know, per minute or liters per minute.
That's a non-technical decision. Well, we put it as a non-technical, I think. So it has to filter, the flow rate has to be fast enough to be, before the water and you can drink it in, a minute.
Right, so and this is going to be a certain volume?
Well, we need to do more research on that.
Right. Well, that's not, what's the main thing wrong with their technical design constraints?
There's only three of them.
Thank you.
Well, that's why you guys should think of make them up.
No, don't make them up. But, I mean, all projects have... These are sort of universal. I mean, they're elements which every project has.
Nice.
So what are wrong with the just scanning these? What's wrong with these?
Too specific.
I mean, when I'm trying to grade documents quickly, I look for the obvious, right?
No numbers,
thank you.
But these are non-practical.
But they still have to have numbers because they have to have be things you can design to.
Well, how do you, like, with local resource, like 100% local resource?
Sustainability. Issues like how long does this thing go before you have to replace the filters or something? Or is it just
so that's with the cost. So if you have to replace the filter after 1 liter filter, then your cost is going to go up.
Right, so you could somehow, you can, I think, specify that in a quantitative way.
But that's the
no, I think your technical constraints need to get more into how this thing, the technical aspects of the filtering. I think the cost and those kinds of things, I consider to be the practical or the non-technical constraints.
Okay.
These are sort of what real-world issues. Okay. So that's a little bit more on design constraints. I hope... I hope that was helpful, and if you need more help, consult with your advisor, consult with me. Let's now talk about the executive summary. So the single most important page in your senior design proposal is the executive summary. This will be right inside the table of contents. You know, you've got the cover page, table of contents, or maybe executive summaries first, I don't remember. But why is the executive summary so important?
Because that's where everything is at, and that's the first thing that the investors want to look at.
Most people who read your document, something like 95% of the people who read your document, especially when it's posted on the web, will never get past the executive summary. I think earlier we've already talked about the concept of the elevator speech. If you can't explain your project in a few seconds to somebody...
Go to the taller building.
Well, I don't know. Some of these elevators are so fast that... So the executive summary is your elevator speech. It's exactly one page, to the line, to the word. Not to the word, you're allowed a little bit of white space at the end of the last sentence, at the bottom of the page. But it's exactly one page.
Shouldn't the executive summary in that case be maximum one page? Because if you can explain your product...
No.
When you push all the buttons...
That's a nice attempt. I give you credit for that. But no, it will be exactly one page, because if it's less than one page, what am I as an investor going to think? Now, this is a little bit me. I'm crazy about this kind of stuff. What? Well, suppose you have two proposals, both asking for $1 million. One has really nice right justification and is exactly one page. One looks like it was written by liberal arts students and, you know, has ragged right page. It's got big white spaces in the middle, maybe a few scrolly thingies around the sides. Which one are you going to choose as engineers? Why?
Because it sounds like it was fully thought out.
Right.
Well, what if you fully think out a three-quarter page?
Okay, here's another point of view on this. If you're not supremely confident about your skills and you're dealing with a boss, is it better to conform to the boss's requirements or take your, you know, try your luck at how really brilliant you are?
We stick with our principles.
So exactly one page. And it's essentially a synopsis of the proposal. So the first, it's typically about four paragraphs. I'm trying to make this easy for you, trying to, you know, help you break it down. The first paragraph is essentially a summary of your problem statement. What are some of the things that you have to do in that first paragraph?
Grab the
grab the attention of the reader. Make them believe this problem is important. The second paragraph is the approach and the design constraints. How are you going about this? What are the key technical challenges in this project? The third paragraph is the results. Now, this is a little bit hard to write at this point because you haven't actually built this thing yet. But, go ahead. It's right. So note that, you know, the design document doesn't have an abstract. It could have an abstract, but generally I prefer the executive summary because in most professional environments I've been in, you do these one-page things. The abstract goes on your website, hopefully on your front page, though some of you have resisted that. But I would expect to see the abstract on your front page of your website. Because, again, people are going to look at your website, they're going to read the abstract, and from that they're going to decide whether they want to go further into the project. So the results, you know, this is going to be a work in progress, but I would like you to take an attempt at writing the results as though your experiments worked out properly. Now, you know, that doesn't mean saying something like, we said the weight was going to be 3 pounds and the weight was 3 pounds. That's more things like you may have a design constraint which says your device must be, let's say, UL approved or something like that. You're going to write a spec. You're going to write a test. You know, if you want to get UL approved, you have to go through a specific series of tests to get that. You're going to talk about those tests. You're going to say, we ran test X, Y, Z, and the results were, you know, 37.5%, and that exceeded the minimum requirements for that test by 2.5%, and we were certified. So it's not just restating the obvious, but it's actually describing a little bit about how you tested this device and how you approved, how you proved that this project met your design constraints. And convincing me as the reader that this thing is it's real, it's been tested, and it meets or exceeds the specifications that you've described. And then the last paragraph is the all-important impact. If you do what you promise, what's the impact of that? What markets will be enabled? You can pull a lot of this from your problem statement. Why should I care about what you've accomplished? A lot of activities where you propose projects to be funded today actually stress this. In research, for example, the sponsors always want to know about what they call broader impact and intellectual merit. Intellectual merit is sort of what is the basic science you're going to accomplish. Broader impact is who's it going to help? How's it going to help society? Those kinds of things. In the business world, impact is things like what markets are going to be enabled, how much money do you think you can make if you achieve the things you're talking about. So on this page, you've got links. Now, most of these are electrical engineering projects because that's mostly what I've taught in the past. Hopefully, after this semester, some of your projects are going to make it to these links. But I've got some excerpts from paragraphs that I think are, you know, pretty well written to give you some examples of how people have done this in the past. And hopefully you can learn a little bit from that writing style and the way they talk about things to get some ideas for your project. Questions on this? The design document lays out the format, executive summary at the top, followed by text. Don't mess with that. That's what you follow. So the one page includes the position of the heading where it's supposed to be, and that kind of thing. Are there questions about the design document? Because another thing that's happening now is you're beginning to integrate all your stuff into the design document, and that's going to be now a document that you'll keep turning in every week with more and more information.
And that's what we were doing to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, the first couple assignments, I didn't force the design document template, but now I am. So in handling your design document, let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of that. What's one of the challenges in doing group writing projects? You've had a little bit of experience with this now.
Collaborating in groups, knowledge.
Collaborating in groups, right? Trying to get people to write different things. So what kinds of processes are you finding helpful in doing that? That's actually true. I mean, you got to sit around and talk a little bit about these things.
We were talking to our advisor about the one thing that you have to watch out for is like making sure it all sounds like it came from the same person.
Right.
And that's probably one of the most difficult parts.
So if an assignment is due, and by the way, I the assignment due dates, I think I'm probably going to, we should just assume Tuesday before class. I mean, if you notice, I don't grade immediately at 8 a.m. Monday. So, you know, we've got a little bit of flexibility on that. But if your thing is due 8 a.m. on Monday, your two-page problem statement, tell me about the process over the course of a week to get to that point where you turn in something really good on Monday morning.
What if it's not really good?
Well, you turn in something on Monday morning. So, 1 week, you know, let's turn the clock back 1 week. You have a meeting, right? What do you do at that meeting?
Assign responsibilities.
Then what happens? You wait until Sunday night, 11:59 p.m. That's the due date, right? You set a deadline for a few days later, maybe middle of the week. What happens? Everybody submits something, and that person edits it. I would say that's not a good, that's not a wise thing. Why? What would be a better strategy? I think you were hinting at it. Yeah. You should all submit your individual contributions to the group and review them sort of independently, right? Because you don't want to spend too much time integrating until you're happy with the pieces. So a couple days later, you share the pieces, everybody looks them over, makes comments, you spend another day fixing up things based on the comments, then what happens? Then somebody integrates, then what happens?
Show your advisor.
It would be good to get your advisor involved at some point soon. Somebody integrates. It goes back to the group for comments. Now tell me about how you're dealing with revisioning.
What I said.
This is a big issue.
It's a dictatorship.
So after you've got this single integrated copy, what's the best way to continue working on that document? Okay, so there's two general approaches once you've got this first integrated version of the document. What's one approach? The approach you don't want to use is what Natalia was hinting at, which is everybody go off and edit in parallel, dump it on some poor person, and they have to do all these integrations, and this person writes in passive voice, this person writes in active voice, you know, this and that. One of the ways that works well is to, first of all, you should all be using the track changes in Word. If you're not familiar with this, I'll show you how to use them. Very easy to use. But it gives you the ability then to back out changes and accept changes and things like that. Secondly, one strategy that I actually use at that point is you want to pass the document from person to person. You don't want everybody doing things in parallel at that point. So set up a designated order, you know, one person to the next, so that when it arrives back, you've got all the edits kind of in a sequential process. Then what's going to happen, then your master writer or who's ever responsible for that phase of the project is going to do another pass and make sure everything is correct, accept all the changes using revisioning, and then submit it back to the group for proofreading, final proofreading, where the focus now is not so much on content, but just on grammar and spelling and, you know, all that nasty stuff. And then you're ready to submit. You're ready to submit when everybody has reviewed the document and signed off on it. Now, through this process, you should be archiving versions of the document. And Google Sites is actually good about this because it gives you an ability to revision documents, especially if you use Google Docs. But you'll notice a lot of the documents I pass around just have version numbers on them. And you can actually put version numbers in the headers and footers in Word if you want to go that route. But when I look at your website, I should really see versions of the document, 00, 01, 02, and just keep those out there through the course of the semester because that's a backup. That's a form of recovery if somehow a document gets corrupted and you need to go back to previous versions of the document. Make sure you're always posting interim copies of the document to your website. Now, how many of you back up your laptops or PCs? Raise your hands.
It's automatic.
What?
It's automatic.
Well, it depends.
You can always restore it. You have restore points, so, yeah.
Well, it depends on what...
And then you can get a backup program and just, like, run it back and...
If you're running Vista, you can back up. But you should be keeping backups of your documents in this course because you're working in a group environment. Make sure there's at least two copies of that document in geographically distributed places, either two different people's machines or zip drives or what, you know, whatever you do, CDs. Put one on the web, one, but make sure that you're constantly backing up because there's a high likelihood through the two semesters of this course somebody's hard drive is going to fail. And I tell you, that happens, amazingly, that happens the last couple of weeks of the second semester when it's really getting tight. And I've already had people write and tell me my machine crashed and we lost documents and things. So back up, back up, back up, and revision, revision, because you have to be able to back out changes and things like that. Okay? And somewhere along the line, we'll actually get to do engineering work. Okay. We have technical presentations coming up in about 3 weeks. That's going to be your first attempt at doing a 15-minute presentation on your project. A convincing 15-minute presentation. So I'll talk about that next week.